Lebanese Arabic, Swedish, French, and English, and with the features of a Swedish mother and Lebanese father, Eli could pass as a local almost anywhere on Earth, a trait that would make him a valuable asset to the U.S. military following 9/11. The two embraced in a hug Reese thought might squeeze the life out of him.
"Thanks for being here, brother. How's the family?"
"Jules and the kids are a little unsure what to do this far from the water, but they're adapting. I want them to live the mountain life for a few years while I help Rafe stand up his Warrior Guardian program. Then we'll probably head back to Cali or the islands. There are a couple business opportunities in the CBD space that I think can really help some of the guys struggling back at the command."
Eli had dropped out of college to serve his country at a time when the Navy needed corpsmen. With the recruiter's promise of a slot at Buds, "Just as soon as you finish corps school," Eli dove headfirst into the world of combat medicine. First assigned to the 1st Marine Division at Camp Pendleton, California, Eli found that getting to Buds once you were in the system was a difficult proposition. He also found he had a propensity for taking care of those in need. Dive MedTech and first-class dive schools followed with eventual orders to SEAL Delivery Vehicle Team 1 in Hawaii. It was there that Eli's eyes were opened to the world of special operations. Following the events of September 11th, the call went out to those with language skills, and Eli raised his hand. He soon found himself on the front lines of the War on Terror as a combat medic for the Redacted. He never made it to Buds, but he'd seen more combat than most who'd passed the Crucible in Coronado, and he'd more than earned the respect of those who wore the Trident.
"I have some gear and cargo," Reese said, nodding back to the plane behind him.
"Well, let's load it up, Kahuna. The rest of the team is waiting at the ranch."
Chapter 63. Columbia Country Club, Chevy Chase, Maryland. If there was a downside to Reginald Pine's job, it was the hours. After a highly lucrative career, he'd played golf 5 days a week, working on the relationships necessary to move up the political ladder. Now he played once a week, if he was lucky. He had joined his usual Saturday foursome early that morning, monitoring the events of the day on his iPhone as he moved across the fairway in his signature pastel pink polo with popped collar. Though the use of cell phones was prohibited on the exclusive club's property and calls were usually restricted to members inside their cars, Pine's position meant that he could bend the rules for official business related to national security. Pine shot well that day, scoring only 2 over par according to his scorecard. He'd picked his ball up once and kicked it out of the rough a few times, but didn't everybody? After a kale salad lunch in the grill overlooking the 18th green, he headed for the indoor pool, glancing at his watch as he walked through the sliding glass doors to confirm that he was on time. A lone figure was rhythmically swimming laps, his body gliding through the water in long, powerful freestyle strokes. Pine took a seat on one of the padded wicker chaise lounges and waited patiently for the man to finish his workout. The swimmer emerged from the pool, paying Pine no notice as he ascended the steps and pulled off his goggles. He wrapped one towel over his Speedo and picked up a second before taking a seat on the chair across from his visitor. Grant LaRue was tall and relatively fit for a man in his 60s, the result of his daily pool workouts. Still, a paunch of belly fat he couldn't quite defeat dangled over the towel as he turned his attention to the president's chief of staff. LaRue was a D.C. lobbyist whose primary clients were overseas companies, mainly Russian. LaRue played by the rules and was paid handsome retainers by businesses based in the largest country in the world. This also gave him plenty of reasons to meet with Russian businessmen on a regular basis. Pine had first met LaRue through a tobacco industry campaign to counter anti-smoking efforts in Russia. The two Washington power players had formed a long and mutually beneficial relationship over the years. In exchange for information from the executive branch, Pine would have a soft spot to land as a partner in Grant's lobbying firm after the next election. Quid pro quo. How was your swim, Grant?
Refreshing as always,
the older man responded, toweling off his short gray hair.
What is it that brings you off the greens?
Just a quick chat. I have some information that might be of use to you.
Shoot!
It seems that one of your Russian friends has a problem with a Montana family last name of Hastings. There was a big shootout at their ranch and someone grabbed their youngest daughter in Romania. Word is they've taken her to some island in the Bering Sea, and that her brother, a Navy SEAL, of all things, has somehow joined her. Sounds like one of your friends is there with them both.
Larus stopped, drying himself.
I'm listening.
You should also know that the CIA wanted to launch a hostage rescue mission, and I put the kibosh on it.
My business associates will appreciate that.
That's not all. Given the personalities involved, I wouldn't be surprised if these deplorables try to go it alone.
Your people should be ready.
How credible?
They're former spec ops types, SEALs and whatnot. They have money behind them, so they may actually have the resources to pull off an attack, a rescue, or whatever you call it.
Grant rubbed his angular chin, his eyes drifting toward the ceiling.
Understood.
Do you, Grant? I want to make sure we are absolutely clear here. Your associates, they need to get rid of these Hastings people and make sure the bodies are never found. I don't need the president getting all patriotic on me. No evidence.
That's a bit harsh, Pine, even for you.
I just want to avert World War III.
If they are still alive, I can assure you they will not be for long. It will be as if they never set foot in Russia.
Good.
My friends will not forget your discretion when your man is out of office.
I'm counting on that, Pine responded as he rose to leave. Let's do lunch one of these days.
Let's do that.
Absolute power. Chapter 64. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. As Reese and Eli approached the main house, the door swung open and Jonathan stepped onto the porch. A motley crew emerged and walked down to the circular gravel driveway. Reese almost choked up, seeing the men who had once been as close to him as brothers answer yet another call. This time it wasn't for the country. It was for a man who had fought with them and offered them a way to transition from military service to the private sector while reconnecting with their families as part of the Warrior Guardian program.
Farkas, Reese said, approaching a redhead who bore an unfortunate resemblance to the bully character in A Christmas Story. In special operations and aviation circles, it was best to just accept your nickname and learn to live with it. The fact that he, like his Hollywood namesake, wore a permanent scowl only added to the legend. A native of Boston, Sean Fleming had been a recce team member at his last command. He'd specialized in advanced force operations, inserting into denied or non-permissive areas, performing reconnaissance missions to identify targets, threats, HLZs, DZs, potential avenues of approach, and escape and evasion corridors. As part of this specialized role, Farkas was a subject matter expert on free-fall parachuting. With thousands of jumps under his belt, he was a tremendous asset when it came to putting men onto a target from the air. Upon his retirement the previous summer, he had come to work for Rafe's outfitting business without hesitation to get some fresh air and figure out his next move. Wearing Carhartts and a t-shirt from Tucson's Trident Bar and Grill, Farkas spit into an empty beer bottle and smiled.
Looks like we'll be jumping out of a perfectly good airplane tomorrow. As I recall, jumping is not your favorite activity.
Good memory, Reese responded. If Reese never exited an aircraft with a parachute again, it would be too soon. He preferred his feet remain firmly planted on the ground.
Just follow me out the back as usual, nothing to worry about.
Just gravity, Reese smiled, and moved on to the next man in line, slapping hands and embracing in a half-man hug. What's up, Devon? Reese asked, as he greeted the golden-haired, board shorts, flip-flop, and tank-top-clad SEAL. Reese couldn't remember ever having seen Devon without a smile. How's Ado doing? Ado sat obediently at his handler's side, awaiting a command. The Belgian Malinois had been Devon Blanding's last multipurpose canine as part of the Naval Special Warfare Canine Program. When Devon was sidelined by an IED that almost killed him in Yemen, Ado never left his side. Knowing that, had he been killed, Ado would have been put down by a system ill-equipped and not funded to run a retirement home for aging attack dogs, Devon found his purpose. After consulting with Rafe, Devon had packed up his 1976 Volkswagen bus pop-top camper and headed to Whitefish. There, he found a beautiful piece of property about 20 minutes outside of town that would allow him to build his dream, Divine Canines. He built a canine facility where he could train personal protection dogs, many for the high-net-worth clients of Rafe's program, as well as service dogs for citizens with impairments and disabilities. With Rafe's help, he started a foundation called Rescue 22, named for the 22 veterans who took their own lives each day in the United States. He trained service and emotional support dogs for veterans dealing with PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and the physical and emotional trauma of combat. A separate section of the property was reserved for retired or transitioning military and police working dogs, animals who would otherwise be quietly put to sleep. He set up an entity called the Warrior Dog Foundation to give them a beautiful place to live out their lives in dignity. Though he still had it, the VW bus had been retired in favor of a new Mercedes 4x4 Sprinter van, custom-built for moving dogs to and from the airport in Kalispell. Ado's doing great, buddy. I think he knows something's up and it's time to come out of retirement. Can I pet him? Does he remember me? Go ahead. He won't kill you. Unless I tell him to, the dog man said only half in jest. Reese knelt and ran his hands down the back of Ado's head, remembering just how many dogs had saved his life over the years. Without multi-purpose canines and dog handlers like Devon, more than a few operators would never have made it home. Standing, Reese turned to the last man in line. Barefoot, he wore dirty jeans and a gray t-shirt, depicting half the face of a Sioux warrior, eagle feathers dangling from his braids. Reese knew the meaning of the feathers, as did the man who wore the shirt. Lawrence Chiaverini was one of Reese's favorite people. No one called him Lawrence or even Larry. Even fewer knew he was actually Italian, most guessing by the dark hair that fell to his waist and the name of his custom knife company that he was Native American. Despite the fact that he had no Native American ancestry, he'd been called Chavez y Chavez after the Young Guns character since first crossing the quarterdeck at Team 5 10 years before. He had grown up in the Black Hills of South Dakota, where his father had the interesting distinction of being the go-to attorney for the bars lining Main Street and the pop-up clubs that appeared out of necessity to handle the overflow drinking traffic just outside of town. He had the respect of the community because he wasn't just some white-collar lawyer there to make a buck. He also ran a motorcycle restoration and mechanic shop, specializing in bikes from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. The law firm paid the bills, but his heart was in the bikes. Young Chavez learned engines and the art of motorcycle restoration and maintenance at the hands of a true master. His dad never talked about the war, but every year when thousands of leather-bound bikers descended on the small town in August, a group of aging Special Forces veterans would make a pilgrimage to the shop. Chavez recognized the SF crest with its motto, De Opresso Liber, Free the Oppressed, on many of the men who passed by to share a drink with his dad. He heard Project Delta mentioned more than once, but the war was something not discussed in the Chiaverini house, perched on the hill overlooking the Black Hills National Cemetery. The machines in his father's shop led to an early interest in knife making. Working on bikes provided young Chavez enough money to slowly acquire the equipment that would one day define him as one of the country's most sought-after knife makers. Grinder, files, drill press, sander, forge, and anvil. Though he worked long hours on bikes and pursued his passion for the traditional skills still being kept alive through a select few Native Americans in the Badlands, his mother still managed to ensure that he would be able to survive in polite society. She taught him to cook, about the subtleties of fine wine, and instilled in him a knowledge and love of Renaissance and Baroque art, all skills and areas of knowledge that would cause more than a few to scratch their heads in wonder. On his fifth deployment in as many years, he was shot multiple times during a room entry that turned out to be an ambush. Before being airlifted to Balad and on to Landstuhl, Chavez escaped from the FOB medical facility and was found naked, knife in hand, on his way to the Iraqi side of the base, threatening to scalp the Iraqi commander he suspected had set them up. The culture of senior-level leaders in the SEAL teams was shifting. What was acceptable and even normal at one time was now grounds for medical retirement. After the medical board cut short his time in uniform, Chavez returned to the Black Hills, adrift. By this time, the reality show frenzy had long since hit, but cameras still followed more than a few stars into the adventure that was the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. A producer who knew his father asked the recently unemployed Chavez if he'd ever done any stunt work in Hollywood. He was about to produce a movie on Benghazi and needed someone who knew special operations to take a few falls. Now, between movies as a fall guy in L.A. and creating custom half-face blades in his shop in Kalispell, many for Rafe's clients, Chavez had found a semblance of peace, though he still wanted to scalp that Iraqi commander.
"Been too long, Reese," Chavez said. "That it has."
The two comrades in arms shared a hug. Then Chavez reached into his back pocket and pulled out a blade in a leather sheath.
"It's a Hunter Skinner. I made it when I heard you were headed back here."
The passing of a blade between warriors who have spilt blood together carried a unique significance.
"Thank you, brother." "Okay, now that you two lovebirds have become reacquainted, what's the plan?"
Jonathan said, looking down from the steps. Glancing at the road behind him, Reese turned back to the Hastings family patriarch.
"While we are waiting on the pilots, we have some weapons to sight in."
Chapter 65. Medny Island, Russia. Alexander Zharkov sat in a high-backed leather chair, his feet resting on an ottoman in front of the fire. The outside of the bunker-like building disguised its luxurious interior, which had the look and feel of a cozy wilderness hunting lodge. Despite the Victorian-era feel of the room, the bunker was equipped with state-of-the-art satellite communications gear, which was appropriate, given its joint ownership by the military and Russia's primary foreign intelligence agency. He scanned the sender and subject lines of his email inbox on the laptop computer balanced on his thigh, a steaming cup of tea cooling on the side table. One name caught his attention, and he double-clicked to open it, waiting impatiently as the message was decrypted by the software. It was from his station chief in Washington, who was running an illegal named Grant LaRue. It was marked Urgent. He read it carefully, and a smile came to his lips. His intended target had taken the bait, and intelligence from LaRue confirmed that there would be no official rescue. That meant a small force of private citizens were likely on their way without a quick reaction force to back them up. His men would tear them apart. And if any survived, he would hunt what was left, the prey of a lifetime. His last chase had left him unsatisfied after his quarry had chosen to take her own life rather than die at his hand. Like a lover who pulled away at the very moment before climax, her act had planted a hunger inside him, one he needed to satiate. He called to Karyavin Vasilyevich, the top Wagner contractor tasked with protecting the island.
Wagner was a private military contracting firm with close ties to Russia's intelligence agencies and was used as a surrogate army in both Ukraine and Syria. Many of the men were veterans of the 2nd Spetsnaz Brigade of the GRU, and all had combat experience. Vasilyevich, who had worn the rank of captain while in the Spetsnaz, appeared in his winter combat uniform with a handgun in a drop-leg holster on his right thigh. He stood rigidly, not quite at attention, maintaining the bearing of his military days.
Captain Vasilyevich, we can expect the Americans any day now.
I will increase patrols immediately. Do we know their method of insertion?
I suspect that they will come from the sea, but there's no way of knowing. We must be ready for anything.
Yes, sir.
Keep all of your equipment shielded inside the bunkers, unless directed otherwise. That is all.
Alexander swore he'd heard the man's heels click before he departed, despite the rubber soles of his winter boots. Chapter 66. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. After confirming dope on the rifles 1149 from the Army, Jonathan led the men into his gun vault. The former Celis scout was a serious collector of firearms, and his gun room was a sight to behold. The 1,000-square-foot rectangular room was constructed of thick concrete, reinforced within by a web of steel rebar. A vault door sealed the room off from the rest of the house, protecting the valuable collection from fire and theft. The interior was finished with rich walnut paneling, giving the room the warmth and glow of a London club. Rack after rack of rifles, shotguns, and handguns lined the walls, ranging in vintage from centuries-old flintlocks to sporting rifles used in the safari heyday of Jonathan's beloved Africa. Alongside them was a selection of modern assault rifles that would rival anything at Fort Bragg, redacted. The guns were arranged from left to right in chronological order, with everything from highly engraved Purdue percussion-era fowling pieces to the coveted Heckler & Koch 416D. As the holder of a Type 7 FFL, as well as a special occupational tax from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, Hastings was able to buy dealer samples of the latest military-grade firearms, including machine guns and suppressors. The team wasn't in the room to admire the collection. They were there because it was the closest thing to a secure conference room. It was highly unlikely that anyone was attempting to listen in on their planning session, but in this business, it was best not to take chances. A large LCD screen had been positioned on a table at the front of the room, and folding chairs were arranged facing it. Caroline had prepared a feast at the rear of the room, and a silver urn of coffee would provide everyone with a steady stream of caffeine as they completed the mission planning process. Thorne had scarcely left Jonathan's side since this ordeal had begun, and he soon joined the growing group of participants. He introduced himself and his two pilots, Liz Riley and Navy veteran Chip King, before Reese took over. "I want to start by thanking all of you for being here. You didn't have to be. The government has decided to opt for a diplomatic solution to bringing Rafe and Hannah home. From what I've learned about our enemy in the past few days, my assessment is that we are working with days, not weeks, to resolve this. My estimate is that as soon as the politicians start talking about this, Rafe and Hannah will be killed and dumped in the sea. I want everyone to consider what's at stake. This is an invasion of a sovereign foreign country. All of us could be executed or rot in a Russian or U.S. jail for this."
"You have to survive the jump first, Reese," Farkas interjected.
"Good point," Reese conceded.
"And that's if you can get out the door before we're shot down by a Russian MiG," Chavez reminded everyone.
"There is that," Reese smiled, knowing the dark humor was part of the deal.
"If you have any doubt, now is the time to say something. Trust me when I tell you that all of us will understand."
Reese paused and looked each individual in the eye for signs of hesitation. As expected, they were all in.
"All right, then.
Reese clicked a remote and began the intelligence briefing he'd borrowed from Andy Danreb at the CIA. The agency was kind enough to put this target package together for us, Reese continued, working through the same briefing he'd received at Redacted, before moving into the tactical portion of the plan. The initial idea was to stage out of the Aleutians and hey-ho in from low-signature aircraft onto the remote side of the island. The rescue force would have then patrolled to the objective, located Hannah and Rafe, then exfilled via the special helicopters the government insists don't exist. The rotary wing assets would stage off an amphibious ship in international waters. Since we don't have those resources, the plan is to use Thorne's G550 to perform a hey-ho jump from international airspace, using the winds to get us into Russian territory and onto Medney Island. From there, we will patrol to the target, though with far fewer ground assets.
Without the stealth helos, how do we get the package home? Farkas asked.
Good question. Thorne will land his albatross on the east side of the island here, Reese said, pointing to a cove on the map. We make our way to him and skim the wave tops until we are back in international airspace. Then it's on to Alaska.
Why not use the Grumman for the insertion? A lot less risk than a jump, Devon asked, thinking of jumping Ado in Arctic conditions.
It's likely the island's radar would pick us up coming in. With the reduced signature of coming in via hey-ho, we can hit the ground and maintain the element of surprise. For extract, we don't have much choice. If the albatross pings on their radar, we will be turning it around and getting back into international airspace before the Russians can positively ID us. If we inserted on it, we'd be sitting ducks.
Check.
What about coming in by boat? Eli asked, wanting to cover all the options.
Finding a boat of sufficient capability and moving it into position could take days. We just don't have that kind of time.
Roger that. I sure miss being able to drop high-speed boats out of a C-17 on a few hours' notice.
There's something else, Reese said. Three of us are going to jump Russian-sourced AKMs. With such a small force, we are going to need every technical and tactical advantage we can get. So our primary weapons are the 416s on loan from Redacted. If the only brass left on site is Black Hills 77 grain made in the USA, we could raise U.S.-Russian tensions to a level not seen since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Wherever we put bodies in the dirt, we are going to have to fill them with 7.62 by 39 and leave Russian brass all over the scene. It won't hold up to scrutiny by the SVR, but it will be enough to give the U.S. plausible deniability and avert a war. The agency was planning to bombard their systems with enough disinformation to sow the seeds of mistrust among the rival gangs. The official stance will be that this looks to be an organized crime hit on the son of Bratva leadership.
What could go wrong? Chavez asked.
That was rhetorical, in case anyone was wondering. Chip, Liz, Reese said, nodding to the pilots.
Hey, guys, I'm Captain Chip King. You can just call me Chip. By the looks of it, I think I've been doing this since before most of you were born, and I've been working for Senator Thornton since he left Congress. I'm going to put you where you need to be, so don't worry about that. I'm afraid I have the easy part.
Chip outlined the G-550's flight plan, which would move the team from Kalispell to the west coast of Washington and then skirt British Columbia on its way to Anchorage. They would land in Anchorage, refuel, and check the weather. The projected winds between the Aleutians and the Russian Commander Islands would determine their exact path toward the target.
Liz will cover the drop, Chip said, deferring to the former Army aviator who was much more in tune with the language of special operations.
Dressed in the Alexo Athletica workout gear and University of Alabama ball cap she wore whenever she wasn't in her pilot's uniform, Liz wasn't a known quantity to anyone in the room, other than Reese, Chip, and Thorne. But it quickly became clear that this was not her first mission brief, as she projected a schematic of the G-550 and explained exactly how the plane would be configured for the jump. Reese noticed that her trademark South Alabama accent abated slightly as she began her portion of the briefing. She could crank it up at will when she needed to lay on the charm and virtually turn it off when she thought it weakened her position. She wasn't
in charm mode today. Farkas followed Liz with a briefing on the pre-jump and exit procedures, sounding like he did it every day, which for many years he had.
"What's the medevac plan?" Eli asked.
"After the drop, we divert to ADAC, refuel, and wait for the call," Liz piped in. "There's an old Air Force field with a 10,000-foot runway at Erickson Air Station on Shemya in the Aleutian chain. It's used as a civilian diversion field now, so we can land there if necessary. If Hannah or anyone else needs immediate medical attention, we can land at Shemya and transfer the patient from the Grumman onto the jet. We can have them on the ground in Anchorage within 2 hours, far faster than the Grumman. If there are no casualties, we will fly back to Anchorage and rendezvous there for the trip home."
"What happens if there's a mechanical failure and the Grumman doesn't make it in?"
"Then y'all better be good swimmers, or we'll have to land the senator's expensive jet in Russia."
Her comment, in her thickest southern drawl, lightened the mood and evoked a few laughs. Thorne grimaced.
"When do we launch?" Devin asked.
"Tomorrow morning, 0600, Reese said. "That gives everyone time to prep gear, and Thorne and Jonathan can get a head start in the Grumman. They are leaving as soon as this briefing is over. They have a long, noisy trip ahead of them."
"Anything else?" Reese asked, scanning the room.
"Yes," Tim Thornton spoke up. "A lot of you know John Barklow down at Sitka."
Heads nodded around the room at the mention of a man who had put most of them through their cold-weather warfare survival training on Kodiak Island in the SEAL teams. He now used that expertise as the big game manager for Sitka Gear and Bozeman.
"I called down and had him send up survival kits for each of you. I know you've gotten used to having an AC-130 overhead and QRF just minutes away. This is not Iraq or Afghanistan. This is Russia. I also have a flare gun up there for each of you. If we can't establish comms, and you get to the coast but can't locate me, put up a flare, and I'll come to you. Jonathan will be with me, and we will be looking. By that time, there shouldn't be anyone left alive on the island to see it."
Heads nodded again as the gravity of what they were about to undertake sank in.
"Jonathan," Thorne said, indicating he was finished.
"Just one thing, lads," the old warrior began. "That you're doing this for our son and daughter means more than my family can ever express. There isn't enough money in the world to compensate you for taking this risk. But as a small expression of my thanks, you will each receive $200,000 for your work. It's the very least I can do. If you don't come back, your family will be taken care of. That, I assure you."
Reese looked around the room, not knowing what to say next.
"Sir," Chavez stood and addressed the man before him. "I certainly can't speak for everyone, but please give my money to Freddie Strain's kid, the one with the special needs."
Reese swallowed hard as a chorus of voices followed suit.
"I'm not one for this kind of emotion, as Caroline can attest," Jonathan said, "but thank you, lads. The deposit will be made. In whose name?"
Reese looked around the room.
"From the Warrior Guardians."
Chapter 67. Medny Island, Russia. Alexander descended the spiral stone staircase into what most would call a dungeon. The intelligence officer thought of it as his hypogeum, the intricate final staging area for man and beast before they were raised into the floor of the ancient Roman Colosseum to meet their fate. In this case, the cages were jail cells with two entrances and exits. One opened to the inside, the area into which Alexander now ventured, and one on the opposite side opened to a ramp leading outside into Alexander's Colosseum, Medny Island. Sergei followed close behind, carrying a large leather satchel. Most people thought of the gladiatorial games as pitting the fiercest fighters in Rome against one another in barbaric battles for the joy of the crowd, but Alexander preferred the Venetian. It was a spectacle in which the beasts of the Republic were set loose against Venators, the most respected hunters in Rome. Though Alexander hunted humans, he thought of them as game. They were his dentati. The level had room for 8 single cells. Six held the Africans from the Central African Republic who had arrived on the latest flight, criminals from the mines who would be executed in Africa or hunted in Russia. Better they have a fighting chance against Alexander and his clients than die on their knees as slaves in the red dirt of their homeland. Alexander and Sergei passed the seventh cage, now empty after its occupant had given Alexander a good warm-up 2 days prior. He was ready. His skills were sharp. He was hungry. They stopped at the last cave, and Alexander came face to face with the adversary he'd been seeking.
S. Rainsford, a clever pen name. I am Alexander Zharkov.
Rafe remained silent, studying his foe with an intensity that sent a chill down Alexander's spine.
A worthy opponent.
My sister, Rafe said.
Your sister is dead. But just like the deer that comes to the feeder, or the leopard who climbs the tree after rotting zebra meat placed there by those who hunt him, you are here.
You are a sick fuck, Rafe spat.
Oh, come now, S. Rainsford. Your writing on our sport is so eloquent. Do not stoop to such a level. Leave that to the Africans. Tomorrow we hunt, or I should say, I hunt. You will be fed well tonight, and just before dawn, the cell doors behind you will open. A ramp will lead you up to ground level, where another door will be open. Sergei will have you in the sights of my very capable Dragunov. It's the only time he uses a modern weapon, and rest assured, he will not miss if you force him to take a shot. Some have chosen this option, but I know that you will not. You want to kill me. I had to ensure you would come and that you would play. It's a pity that your friend James Reese isn't here with you. How I would have loved to hunt you both. If I don't kill you tomorrow, he'll finish the job. Unfortunately for us both, that will not be the case. Your friend Reese is on his way here now with a makeshift band of misfits. In all likelihood, they will be slaughtered by my security forces as they make landfall. You look surprised, S. Rainsford. Do you think our intelligence apparatus died at the end of the Cold War? I can assure you, it is still very much in place, stronger now than it ever was. And if I don't play? Ah, you will play, S. Rainsford. You will play because that is your only chance to kill me. I hunted your sister out of this very cage,
Alexander said, looking around as if recounting a fond memory.
Don't worry. She was treated well. She was not violated. I needed her in top condition. She was strong, that one. Strong and smart.
Rafe and Alexander's attention was drawn to a scraping sound as Sergei pushed a table across the cold cement floor, positioning it in front of Rafe's cage.
I want you motivated tomorrow, S. Rainsford. I know you will be, but just in case, this should help.
Sergei handed his master the leather satchel which Alexander placed on the table, unclasping the two brass buckles that held it closed. With great respect and ceremony, Alexander reached inside and pulled out a large glass container. Looking admiringly at its contents, he placed it on the table in front of Rafe's cell.
Good luck tomorrow, Rainsford, he said,
before walking to the stairs that led to the main level. Already thinking of the thick moose steaks Sergei would grill for their supper. He left Rafe alone in his cell, staring into the lifeless, upturned eyes of his dead sister. Chapter 68. Glacier Park International Airport, Kalispell, Montana. A Gulfstream G550, also known as a G5SP, is one of the most versatile and luxurious business jets that money can buy. With a $45 million price tag, it was built for comfort and speed over extended distances. Despite its spacious interior, which can accommodate up to 19 passengers, it was not designed to accommodate 5 hey-ho jumpers, a dog, and all the weapons and gear necessary to perform a clandestine night insertion into a foreign nation via parachute. The aircraft's interior was divided into 3 main sections: a forward club section with 4 leather seats facing one another over a small table, a 4-place divan configured sideways with 2 seats across the aisle, and an aft sleeping compartment. This arrangement allowed every member of the rescue team a seat, leaving their gear distributed around the cabin and in the aft baggage area. For operators accustomed to making transcontinental flights on the nylon-strapped seats of military transport aircraft, it was a crowded but welcome change. The team inspected, checked, and double-checked their gear before loading it onto the plane. As Jumpmaster, Farkas carefully inspected each parachute rig before they were loaded, since conditions before the jump would not be as ideal for doing so. If one didn't know any better, it looked like a professional soccer or rugby team was boarding the aircraft for an away match. "Farkas, can you rig this up for me?" Reese asked, extending the Eccles legend his father had given him.
"I knew you were going to grab a sniper rifle," Farkas smiled. "Yeah, I'll rig it up."
"Just in case," Reese said.
"Just in case," Farkas acknowledged.
In the absence of a flight attendant, Liz performed the FAA-mandated safety briefing and indicated the location of the emergency exits.
"The forward cabin door is the primary means of exiting the aircraft, but additional exits over the wing can be accessed in an emergency," she said, doing her best flight attendant hand sweep toward the window exits. "In the event of a high-altitude jump over a hostile nation, the aft baggage door is the preferred method of egress," she said, evoking a laugh from the team.
The plane accelerated down the runway and surged skyward thanks to its powerful Rolls-Royce engines. Within minutes, they were at their cruising altitude of 40,000 feet, moving at a steady speed of Mach 0.83. What always surprised Reese was how quiet this aircraft was, its engineers obviously spending far more time and effort on passenger comfort than those who designed airliners. As soon as the plane took off, every operator went into their own world, listening to music, reading, or sleeping. Eli went into the crew rest compartment and began laying out medical gear in case the Gulfstream became an air ambulance. IV drips were prepared, bandages arranged, and various medications were lined up on the nightstand. Satisfied that things were as ready for an emergency as they could be, he returned to his seat and opened a Russian language app on his iPhone. Reese couldn't sleep. He spent his time deep in thought, going over the jump, the contingencies at every phase of the operation. With no backup, there were only 2 words to describe what they were about to attempt: suicide mission. Those who were sleeping were jolted awake as the plane touched down in Anchorage and slowed to turn off runway 7 right. The operators peered out the windows at the unique array of aircraft. Everything from balloon-tired Super Cubs to various float planes were visible in what seemed like every direction. Due to Alaska's size and the remote location of many of its cities, towns, and wilderness areas, it has the highest per capita rate of aircraft ownership in the nation. The Gulfstream taxied to Signature Flight Support, one of the field's fixed base operators, where the engines were shut down. The window shades were lowered, and Liz opened the cabin door to coordinate refueling. All 5 of the rescuers stayed on board and out of sight, no sense arousing any suspicions about the nature of their journey or cargo. The cold air blowing through the open door was a warning of the temperatures they'd be facing when they eventually exited the aircraft. Eli made a comment under his breath about these being sub-Hawaiian temperatures as he pulled a stocking cap over his head. Once the plane was fueled, the pilots used an iPad application called 4Flight
to file their flight plan electronically. According to that plan, they would travel from Anchorage to Haneda Airport in Tokyo, Japan, via Bethel, Alaska, and on to Route R220, which passed almost directly over the Commander Islands, though they had no intentions of following that route all the way to Tokyo. They also filed an E-APIS report with the Department of Homeland Security, a requirement when filing an international flight plan. Only the pilots' names were listed on the report, since the five commandos in the back would not be aboard when the plane made its next stop. Since they had so recently landed, the pilots performed a rotor bow, motoring the engines for 30 seconds to thermally stabilize them before the start sequence was initialized. All systems read normal as the engines idled and the takeoff procedures began. They were wheels up within the hour, and once airborne, Liz announced they were 3 hours and 26 minutes out from the drop. Reese leaned back in his seat. Next stop, Russia. Chapter 69. As they flew over the Alaskan Peninsula, Reese warmed up dinner, piping hot bowls of venison chili and freshly baked cornbread, all prepared by Caroline Hastings in advance of their departure. They devoured what they knew could be their last meal. Reese pressed his head against the window and looked down at the lights of sparsely populated villages. He wondered how many Americans remembered that the only land battle of World War II fought on American soil took place on the barren volcanic islands 30,000 feet below. The Battle of Attu was all but forgotten these days. 549 U.S. troops lost their lives defending home soil from Japanese invaders in May 1945. 1,148 were wounded, and 1,814 were taken out of the fight for cold injuries and disease. The battle marked one of the largest banzai charges of the war. Of the 2,379 Japanese troops that began the battle, only 28 survived to be captured. The battle also drove the military to improve cold weather warfare gear, innovations that continued to evolve into what Reese and his men would use on Medney Island. One by one, they hit the lavatory and began dressing for the mission. When exiting an aircraft at this altitude, temperatures could be minus 50 centigrade. Without protection from the cold, they would freeze to death in minutes. These extreme temperatures required them to wear several layers of synthetic clothing specially designed for Arctic warfare. The clothing system, known as the Protective Combat Uniform, PCU, was developed by the Army's Natick Soldier Systems Center with input from alpine climbing legend and Jim Jones founder Mark Twite and manufactured by Patagonia. White and gray splotched multi-cam alpine combat overwhites completed the ensemble, topped off with body armor before donning specially designed Heho gray synthetic thermal suits that would be discarded once they hit the ground. Farkas received a weather update from the cockpit that he used to make his final navigational calculations. The Gulf Stream was indicating winds from 250 degrees at 40 miles per hour, which matched the earlier forecast and gave him confidence that the report was accurate. They would be at the absolute limits in terms of their gliding distance to the target. If the winds shifted, or worse, reversed, they would find themselves in the icy Bering Sea, dead within minutes. Farkas reinspected each man's gear, physically running his hands across every strap, every buckle, every seam. There would be no second chances. Route R220 ran parallel to Russia's Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ. It was important to stick to established commercial airline routes when making a covert insertion into denied territory. If they deviated too far from the official route, Russian radar operators monitoring the Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky airspace would take note of their location and alert interceptor aircraft based in Magadan. A MiG-31 could shoot down the Gulf Stream from 200 miles away. To avoid that disaster, the pilots only allowed their course to divert slightly from the center of the route, putting them at the absolute edge of the ADIZ, 48.5 miles from the tip of Medney Island. Devon let Ado walk among the operators, sniffing and saying hello. The dog handler wanted Ado to know the difference between friend and foe if he was given the command to bite. Using the buddy system, the band of mercenaries donned parachutes with ATAC, or Android Tactical Assault Kits, in a chest-mounted Juggernaut navigation board MFF-T2, with backup Garmin Fortrex GPS and Oceanic Compass, in case the primary system failed. The ATAC was a military-specific smartphone app that provided users with real-time geospatial situational awareness, communication, navigation, and targeting information. Their weapons had been fitted with tape to hold down anything they didn't want flying off in the violence of exiting an aircraft moving at 500 miles per hour. The muzzle, ejector port, handguard, optics, laser, and magazine all had riggers tape adhering them to the rifles, which were mounted horizontally across their waists. Reese had the added benefit of having the Eccles Legend strapped vertically to his right side in a padded case with foam taped around the scope, just in case. Weapons were strapped to jump harnesses, and with a final check of nods, helmets were secured in place, oxygen masks dangling to the sides. The G550 was flying at 35,000 feet, but the cabin was pressurized for 8,000. An hour out from the drop, the cabin pressure was adjusted to 10,000 feet. The commandos took their seats and plugged into a supplemental O2 unit on the floor of the aircraft. Resembling a large Pelican case with dials and knobs that looked foreign to Reese, it allowed the jumpers to breathe 100% oxygen without depleting the small green tanks strapped to their chests. Ado had a nasal cannula rigged inside his muzzle. Reese always wondered how much O2 the dogs were actually getting. Decompression sickness, otherwise known as the bends, is an ailment usually associated with scuba diving, but the risks of such a physiological event are equally as great during high-altitude parachute jumps. Residual nitrogen in the bloodstream can, upon descent, turn into bubbles that can migrate throughout the body and cause pain, paralysis, and death. To prevent the onset of decompression sickness, they pre-breathed for an hour. Any nitrogen remaining in their bodies, even any ingested while switching oxygen tanks, could be deadly. The exercise of breathing pure oxygen prior to exiting the aircraft allowed them to get into the zone, running through the contingencies of the complex mission. Reese reviewed MET-TC, mission, enemy, terrain, troops available, time, and civilian considerations. The mission was clear: find Rafe and rescue Hannah. Enemy: the target package from the agency briefing, redacted, estimated that Alexander had a security detail of no more than 10 private contractors. Terrain: mountainous, harsh, and cold. Troops available: Reese looked around the plane at his assault force. 5 plus a dog. Time: if they made it in without detection, they would have 4 hours to complete the mission and make it to meet Thorne and Jonathan in the Albatross at extract. Civilian considerations: non-applicable. All civilians had been force relocated 15 years ago. Reese found himself wondering why. Alexander didn't have the island then. The Russian government had moved them.
Never mind that now, Reese. Focus.
At 20 minutes out, the silence was broken by Liz's voice over the intercom system. Farkas switched to his portable bailout O2, moved to the rear of the cabin, and pushed open the polished door that led to the aft baggage compartment. The jumpers all wore clear goggles so the team medic could check for signs of decompression sickness, the bends, the chokes, neurological hits, and skin manifestations. Eli looked for pupil dilation or constriction, which could signify a nitrogen bubble expanding in the brain, and checked for signs that anyone was hyperventilating or scratching at their suits. The team looked ready. At 10 minutes out, the interior cabin lights were extinguished and everything went completely dark. Reese flipped down the L3 Harris GPNVG18 night vision goggles attached to his helmet. The 97-degree panoramic view provided by the 4 images intensifiers helped eliminate the tunnel vision effect of the earlier nods he'd used in the SEAL teams. It wasn't quite daylight with the goggles in place, but it gave them an advantage over those without them. At the two-minute mark, oxygen lines were disconnected, leaving the men to breathe from their bailout bottles attached to their kit. Each jumper checked their buddy's O2 system, pressure, regulator, indicator, connections, and emergency equipment. Reese considered the possibility that his oxygen system would freeze in the extreme air temperatures. If that happened, hypoxia would set in quickly, and he would die a euphoric death, no doubt unaware of his fate. He shifted his thoughts to the jump sequence, suppressing the notion of when he'd last worn a parachute. The pilots donned their emergency oxygen masks, took a few deep breaths to ensure a good seal, and checked the internal microphones. Then, with a concerned glance at one another, they depressurized the cabin to a cacophony of master caution warnings and audio alerts. Both pilots had added layers of clothing to protect them from the frigid air. The men in the rear stood in single file, the first two inside the baggage area and the rest lined up behind them in the aft lavatory and into the cabin. Farkas reached up and activated the infrared strobe mounted on his helmet, and each man followed suit. Soon, all eight strobes flashed inside the cabin, which was disorienting to say the least. The flashing lights, invisible to anyone not wearing night vision equipment, would help the jumpers keep track of one another in the darkness until they could stack up and turn them off. Bad guys sometimes had night vision devices as well. 1 minute out, the whine of the twin turbofans abated significantly, slowing the jet's airspeed to one that wouldn't rip the jumpers and their gear to pieces when they exited the aircraft. With the aircraft trimmed to just above stall speed, the cabin differential pressure was equalized to allow Farkas to turn the handle and opened the aft baggage door, which slid up along internal tracks. He attempted to open it slowly, but the hurricane force winds snatched the latch from his hands and slammed it open so hard that he thought it would be ripped from its hinges. The engineers in Savannah had done their jobs well, and it stayed attached to the plane. The cargo door on the G550 lies just below the left engine nacelle at the rear of the aircraft, which meant that the risk of impacting the fuselage or any other part of the aircraft upon exit is minimal. The quiet ride suddenly became deafeningly loud. The combination of the howling winds and the jet engine just above the hatch drowned out any chance of verbal communication. The cold air was equally shocking to the senses, even with all the layers of specialized clothing. Farkas studied the open hatch as well as his ATAC screen in sequence, the nods exaggerating his head movements as he did so. He pantomimed a countdown from 5 seconds. Then, without hesitation, he exited through the open hatch into the darkness, each jumper following as closely behind him as the cramped space allowed. The sound of the jet engine was overwhelming as Reese passed underneath, but it faded away almost instantly as the aircraft sped into the night. He found a stable body position and deployed his primary parachute. The small pilot chute unfurled the nylon canopy and violently arrested Reese's freefall. After confirming that his canopy had deployed as designed, he scanned for the flashing strobes that indicated the position of his teammates. One by one, he counted them until he'd confirmed that the other jumper's chutes had opened. They didn't bunch up to avoid creating a radar signature. Instead, they switched off their IR strobes and flew in a loose formation behind Farkas's lead, 25 yards apart. After the exhilaration of free fall and the dread of ensuring everyone was accounted for, Reese concentrated on maintaining his position behind Devon. He could see Edo's head and tail. The dog was strapped into Devon's harness, and Reese couldn't help but wonder what the canine was thinking as he descended from the heavens. As they glided toward the objective, Reese made tiny course corrections by reaching up and pulling on the parachute's toggles, their forward momentum carrying them deeper into Russian territory and toward their target. Despite the cold, it was quite peaceful, the only sound the wind howling at their backs. Reese looked down and below his boots, saw only darkness. According to the ATAC screen, they were on course and maintaining sufficient speed and altitude to make it to Medney Island with a bit of air to spare. His oxygen appeared to be flowing normally, and his mind was clear and alert. All Reese had to do for now was follow the leader. So far, despite the long odds, everything had gone according to plan. But, as Reese knew all too well, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Chapter 70. 40,000 feet above the Bering Sea. It took all of Liz Riley's significant body strength to wrench the aft baggage door into the closed position. Thankfully, when she wasn't flying airplanes, she was moving large stacks of iron in the weight room. She knelt in the baggage area in silent prayer, asking God to watch over the avenging angels who had just leapt into the darkness. After a few moments of quiet reflection, she unhooked the safety line she'd rigged to prevent her falling into the abyss and made her way back to the cockpit. The captain immediately began the repressurization of the cabin and cranked the onboard climate control to its highest heat setting. 15 minutes later, both pilots were able to take off their oxygen masks and lose a couple of layers. Making a hard turn off their flight plan was bound to raise a few eyebrows, so they carefully drifted back toward the center of their course and resumed their airspeed and altitude. They'd continue a full 40 minutes past the drop, at which point Liz would call Anchorage Oceanic Control and report cabin pressurization issues. She would request a rerouting to ADAC, where they could land and have the system inspected by maintenance crews. That would put them as close as possible to their emergency rendezvous location without arousing too much suspicion. As the jet roared through the night sky, Liz couldn't help but return to her faith. She whispered a quiet prayer to the patron saint of paratroopers.
Saint Michael the Archangel, defend them in battle. Be their protection against the enemy.
Medny Island, Russia. Alexander Zharkov was in the bunker's command center where the weapon was controlled. Three uniformed operators manned the computer stations, each of them wearing headsets with lip microphones. One of them was in contact with the nation's air defense network, which operated early warning systems that dated back to the Soviet era. A jet traveling nearby had strayed a few miles from its course, putting it at the limit of the air defense identification zone. It was time. Grant LaRue, his SVR placed illegal, never failed to provide the highest quality intelligence. He was running his own source inside the White House, the American president's own chief of staff, who believed he was passing information to a trusted friend who had a high-paying job waiting for him when he left politics. A useful idiot. The weapons system on this island was the largest of its kind in the world, and so far the tests had been extremely successful. The underground generators, capacitors, and dish emitters formed the basis of a directional EMP designed to render the technological advantages of modern armies useless in an instant. An EMP is an electromagnetic pulse, a short burst of invisible energy. EMPs can be caused by coronal mass ejections from the sun, lightning, or nuclear detonations, varying significantly in size and scope. Though EMPs are harmless to humans, they can cause permanent damage to electronic components. The system in place on Medny Island was a proof of concept, one that would activate an invisible dome-like shield above the area. It was Russia's experimental answer to the U.S. missile defense system. Guided missiles, aircraft, and even drones could be knocked out of the sky instantly. Mobile systems could send an entire battle space back into the 19th century, while larger fixed weapons, such as this one, could potentially shield entire installations or cities from nuclear attack. Their only challenge at this point was projecting the pulse far enough into the atmosphere to interrupt nuclear-armed re-entry vehicles. This system effectively protected the entire island up to an altitude of 1,000 meters. Zharkov glanced at the watch on his wrist before speaking.
Move the men inside the bunkers. In 20 minutes, begin pulses every 60 seconds.
It will be done.
The contractors, their radios and night vision devices would be shielded inside the hardened bunkers while the weapon was in use. Once they had confirmation that the invaders were on the ground, Alexander would let slip his hired dogs of war. Chapter 71. Medny Island, Russia. Rhys could see the island now, a long white blur against the dark sea below. He trusted their equipment, and his belief in Farkas's abilities was near absolute, but it was still a tremendous relief to see dry land. He thought about the four SEAL operators who had drowned during Operation Urgent Fury in Grenada. No matter how hard you train, Mother Nature and the enemy still get a vote. With the island in sight, Rhys began to use his toggles to fly the chute toward the LZ, following the stack of jumpers before him. He glanced down at the ATAC screen and double-checked the oversized altimeter strapped to his wrist. Then Rhys's entire world went black. He assumed that the cold had sapped the batteries in his nods, but to be sure, he tried his go-to solution for all problems electronic, turn them off, and then back on. Nothing. He flipped the nods up and out of the way, seeing only a ghost of the illuminated image the night optics had provided seconds earlier. The ATAC screen on his chest was as black as his nods. Even though the device was set to the very dim night vision mode, he should have seen at least a faint glow. He pressed the button on the side of the device. What the hell? Rhys unbuckled the oxygen mask from his face, let it fall to one side, and pulled the boom mic on the Peltor headset toward his mouth. His other hand found the talk button through the fabric of his thermal suit. Spartan 2-1, this is Spartan 0-1, over. Nothing. Any Spartan, this is 0-1, over. No response. Straining, he heard a faint sound ahead, just above the howling of the wind, a human voice. The men were improvising, calling out to one another as beacons to guide them to the target. Rhys pushed his earmuff headset ajar to better hear his teammates in the darkness. They risked detection by making noise, but missing the target and landing in the icy waters meant certain death. Rhys steered his chute by sound, following the voices in the wind. As his eyes grew accustomed to the dark, he began to make out something in the distance. The faint white of the snow-covered islands stood out in contrast to the blackness around it. Rhys had spent enough time studying satellite imagery of the island to know where they were supposed to land. He was a product of an earlier era in which computers, GPS devices, and even nods could not be depended upon. He'd been trained and mentored by Vietnam-era SEALs and had learned to navigate by terrain association. As a young frogman, Rhys had lived by the map, compass, and iron sights. Those skills, ancient by the standards of today's generation of special operators, were about to save his life. The analog altimeter strapped to his wrist still worked, the tritium-impregnated hands sweeping slowly as he descended. Rhys confirmed that he had sufficient altitude to allow him to glide into the target. He would rather come in high and turn into the wind than risk being too low. He could hear the roaring waves crashing against the island's sheer cliff walls, which was yet another indicator that he was getting close. The wind picked up speed, pushing Rhys more rapidly toward the unknown DZ. The combination of frigid air and the pounding surf made it difficult to discern the voices of his fellow team members. His course was a bit farther to the right than he intended, so he tugged the toggle with his left hand. A drastic correction could be disastrous, so he was careful to make slight movements. The island was long and narrow, resembling the far smaller but similarly configured profile of Long Island, New York. A series of high peaks ran across the center spine of the landscape, providing few, if any, suitable landing zones. Rhys's target was a saddle between two mountaintops, roughly at the island's longitudinal center. He could make out two snow-covered mountaintops below, and as he steered toward them, he desperately hoped that they were the correct ones. His mind wasn't on the mission now. It wasn't on saving Hannah, finding Rafe, or getting back to Katie. All of his focus was on landing his chute. The terrain grew closer, rushing toward him as his perspective changed. Rhys looked down over his boots and saw that he was officially feet dry, meaning he had crossed from the ocean and was over land. His mind went through a checklist, consulting the altimeter, studying the terrain, making slight course corrections, and scanning the horizon for any sign of another jumper. He glided toward the mountains, dropping rapidly. He needed to slow down or risk overshooting his target. He'd expected the wind to die off as he approached land, but the valley created the opposite effect. It effectively formed a wind tunnel that threatened to blow him into the sea. His airspeed provided him plenty of stability, but not the angle of approach that he needed. He was still 50 feet off the ground, and the saddle was beginning to fall away below him as the slope plunged toward the water. Reese pulled hard on his left toggle,